Thanks for tuning in for the June 9th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals. This week's first segment continues a conversation on the management of migraine. In the second segment, you'll hear a talk on the role of neurofilament light as a biomarker after mild traumatic brain injury. Please remember that we offer free CME for each eligible podcast. Simply find the Neurology podcast episode online and click on the CME quiz link. We offer up to 60 hours of CME for past shows, all available online. It's easy and free for AAN members.
Hey, this is Jason Crowell from Beth Israel Deaconess in Boston. And once again, we have Dave Watson joining us from West Virginia University. Last week, Dave joined us and we started our conversation by covering some very practical, tried and true tips for treating patients with episodic migraine. Today, Dave joins us for part two, and we're going to talk about special patient populations that we may encounter as we treat patients for migraine, including those from underserved areas, those who are uninsured or underinsured. So, Dave, thank you, first of all, for joining us back on the Neurology Podcast.
Thank you for having me again, Jason.
I think it might be helpful if we start with some context, if you wouldn't mind, just maybe a minute or two. Tell us a little bit about your practice in West Virginia and how you came to take an interest in these special populations of patients with migraine.
Sure. Well, first of all, I was born and raised in West Virginia, was gone for a bit of my training and early in my career, and then got an opportunity to come back. So I've always had somewhat of an understanding of some of the unique challenges of not specifically to West Virginia, but of rural populations from a medical standpoint, of having access to physicians and expertise. So when I came back to West Virginia to try to start a headache program, I quickly ran into a couple of things that I noticed. One was that so few of my patients lived in the same town where my clinic was. And this, of course, was before the days that everyone was talking about telemedicine. And so my options were to think about trying to go out and do satellite clinics or just make people drive to see me. And honestly, I was so busy locally doing the satellite clinics didn't really work. But it's always been something that I've struggled with, which is it's great for us to build a great headache program here in Morgantown, West Virginia, as part of our neurology department. But how do we help that person who lives 4 hours away from us get the same care that the person that lives 10 minutes away from us? And that is a challenge I have not fully solved yet, but we are working on it.
Terrific. So with that in mind, thinking about patients who are in geographically underserved areas, have you adopted telemedicine? I should mention that we're recording this podcast in the end of April, the last day in April. And so everything has changed really in the last 2 months in terms of telemedicine. We've covered that quite a bit on the podcast, but I'm interested to know how you've adopted telemedicine into your practice or what kind of challenges you've encountered as you've tried to use that technology.
I almost am embarrassed to say that we did not do telemedicine until COVID forced us to do telemedicine. We actually were just getting ready to open up our first telemedicine satellite clinic, and we were going to just dip our toe in the water one day a month to see how it would work. But with the COVID crisis and all of the stay-at-home regulations, we did about 2 years worth of transition of our practice in about 2 weeks and are now doing close to 80% of all of our visits through telemedicine. Honestly, it's been almost entirely great. Patients seem to really like it and appreciate it. They get to stay home. I can do telemedicine from my clinic. I can do it from my office. In theory, I could do it from my home. Oh, I haven't tried that yet. It saves the patient money. It saves them time. The biggest challenge that we have, and some of this, I think, goes back into this idea of the rural population, is that we have a significant population that does not have consistent high-speed internet capability. So oftentimes we're trying to do video connections, the video connection is really poor quality or it cuts out, and we end up having to convert just to a telephone conversation. It makes it a little hard to do a decent physical exam. So I think that in the long run moving forward, we will certainly utilize this for our return patients who really just need medication checks and refills and adjustments. We will use it some for new patients, but I'm probably going to be much more comfortable seeing a patient once in person where I can really put them to their paces and feel comfortable about their exam. But in a pinch, doing a new patient visit via telemedicine, I think will still be an option for us. The other thing actually I didn't realize is how many of our patients don't actually have smartphones. So even if you have good internet, if you don't have a webcam or a smartphone, the video connection doesn't do you much good. And so we have to try to figure out some of those problems moving forward.
Yeah, that's a good reminder. And it also makes me wonder, just thinking out loud here, if there's not some way to partner with either like local health departments or some other type of organization that could provide those patients with internet so that they could at least connect virtually, maybe even, I don't know, sitting in their car to have a doctor's visit. I'm not sure if anyone's looked into that, but that's something that could potentially help those patients.
Yeah, you sound like some conversations we've had over the past 2 weeks, which is when this is, I hate to use the word over, I'm not sure the COVID is ever going to be over, but when it starts to return back to normalcy, what's our long-term plan going to be? And we've talked about having people go to their local doctor's office and connect there, their local hospital. We even talked about trying to connect with public libraries and creating a quiet, private place in a public library where someone could go. So we have a lot of this stuff to figure out. And right now we're sprinting as fast as we can and just trying to keep up.
Great. So now thinking about patients who are either underinsured or uninsured, or patients who are at risk for experiencing financial toxicity from the medications we prescribe or the treatments that we recommend, how does cost and the financial side of things influence the choices you make when you're picking a treatment or managing a patient with migraine?
Well, Jason, it's something I have to think about every day. I think this is a good place for me to put a plug in for the Palatucci Advocacy Leadership Forum, which is a program through the Academy of Neurology, which trains people how to be advocates for their profession as well as for patients. And it's a program I went through a number of years ago and has stuck with me, and I think provided some tools that I use on a fairly regular basis in trying to help my patients who have financial challenges. I did a little digging, knowing you were going to ask me something about this, just going online, looking at comparative drug costs. And these may not be entirely accurate because I used one source on the internet, but you know, a 50 milligram amitriptyline prescription for a month costs anywhere from $4 to $15. Propranolol, 60 milligrams for a month, costs $15 to $27. Topiramate, 100 milligrams for a month, costs $10 to $50. And if you compare that to some of the new CGRP antibodies, which all cost around $600 to $650 per month, these are decisions that people have to make if they don't have good insurance coverage. And honestly, even people who do have good insurance coverage, I think as just a person trying to be a good steward of America's healthcare resources, it is still something I think that's reasonable for us to think about. So I don't want to downplay how great it is to have new treatment options in the migraine field, because it really is amazing. We've been kind of in a desert for a long time as far as new options in migraine, and now we suddenly have had somewhat of an explosion of new options, and it's making a huge difference for a lot of patients, and that is wonderful when I use these drugs regularly. But we can't forget that the stuff that we've used for the past 20 or 30 years still worked for an awful lot of people, and because they're now 20 to 30 years old or older, are actually way more affordable, and in the right patient can still be very much the right option. And so in patients that have insurance limitations or don't have insurance, or even if they have insurance, they have one of these 80-20 plans, I like to think about, can I use the old stuff for them effectively, just as I did, you know, 2 years ago when those were my only options, and not forget about those now that we have these new options. And I'll tell you, one of the things I've run into is I'll see patients who have been referred to me where in another doctor's office, they were given a sample of a month or 2 months of one of these new injectable CGRP drugs. And then they couldn't get it through their insurance. And so they got a taste of benefit, and then they lost it because now they can't afford it. And that's where I get sometimes frustrated. Why didn't we just try the thing that the patient could get and was probably going to work for them also and try that first, rather than jump to the big gun first and then have to pull it away from the patient because it's actually not a long-term viable option? Those are the things that frustrate me for my patients at times, but it is tempting because these new drugs are exciting and effective and they're new, and that makes it tempting to use them.
I think that's a great point, Dave. And certainly, you know, these new drugs, as you mentioned, they're extremely effective and exciting for our patients. But at the same time, you know, just in the same way that we would talk to our patients about the efficacy and tolerability and safety of a medicine we would prescribe, I think we have to consider the cost, the financial side of things, and assess whether this induces financial toxicity in a patient. And if it does, then are we really helping them? So I think that's a great reminder for all of us.
One of the advantages that I have found to living in a small rural state is that my ability to advocate for my patients at a state level, I think, is probably greater than it would be living in a much more populated state. For example, when it comes to these new CGRP antibodies, I was able to connect with the leadership of the state Medicaid program and work with them on creating a pathway. And based on what I said earlier, I mean, it's still a pathway that requires you try other options first, but they were very happy to work with me and trust my judgment and connect. And now I have a relationship with our Medicaid decision makers in how we cover medication for our most vulnerable population. And I think that is something that's important to remember, that you know, we love to fight with insurance companies. We love to make them the bad guy, but sometimes they can actually be a partner in helping to make good decisions for our patients.
That's terrific. Thank you for that reminder. Let me ask you before we wrap up here, anything else, any other parting thoughts about special populations with migraine that you think we should consider?
Yeah, there's one thing. And first, I'd just say that when we think of underserved populations, every person in the United States and probably every person in the world who has migraine would, in my mind, qualify as being an underserved population. There are 80,000 patients in the United States with migraine for every one certified headache specialist in the country. And even if you count all neurologists, there's 2,400 patients with migraine for every one neurologist in the country. And so other than some very small pockets where you have a constellation of headache specialists, everyone with migraine suffers from a lack of access to headache expertise. In West Virginia, where we work and we looked at a month's worth of our patients, we found that the average distance a patient traveled one way was 70 miles to see us. And 27% of our patients traveled over 100 miles one way to come see us.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that creates a burden, not only of just do I have insurance, and you know, there are a lot of underserved populations, largely based on economic status, where people have insurance limitations. But even if you have insurance, then you've got to take a day off. You've got to spend money for gas. You might even have to get a hotel room. You've got to get a friend to drive you if you don't drive. I mean, it creates additional burden. And I am hopeful, like we talked about with telemedicine, that this is one of the areas that we can relieve that burden. But we need more people out there with headache expertise being able to provide excellent care to patients with migraine.
Thank you, Dave, for joining us and talking with us today, as well as last week, and reminding us of these patients and how we can help them. I think it's been a great conversation. To our audience, Dave published an article on migraine treatment in these special populations of patients. If you'd like to read more of his recommendations, it was published February 21st, 2019 in Current Pain and Headache Reports. And the title of the article is Unique Considerations for Special Populations in Episodic Migraine, the Underserved. Dave, thank you once again so much for your time and for talking with us these last 2 weeks. We really appreciate it.
Jason, this has been great fun. I appreciate the opportunity and look forward to hearing more of your podcasts.
Wonderful. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you, guys.
This is David Lapidus with the Neurology Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Kimbra Kenny and Jessica Gill. Kimbra is a neurologist at NICO at Walter Reed in Bethesda, Maryland, and Jessica is acting deputy director of the National Institute of Nursing Research and a senior investigator at NIH. They're here to talk to us about their paper, Exosomal NFL, a prognostic biomarker for remote symptoms after mild traumatic brain injury. Jessica and Kimbra, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, David, for inviting us and allowing us an opportunity to highlight the work that we have ongoing.
Of course. So Jessica, let's start with you. We've got a few players here in your paper. And before you explain the findings specifically, can you help me and our listeners make sure we understand the terminology? Namely, what is exosomal NFL in contrast to plasma NFL?
NFL, or neurofilament light chain, is a protein that we usually see in neurons. It's in high concentration in the cytoplasm of large myelinated neuronal axons. Normally, it's not found in circulating plasma. But what we know is that following a brain injury, neurons are damaged. We also know that with degeneration, NFL can increase in the plasma, indicating some type of neuronal damage or neurodegenerative process. More recently, in our lab, we've been able to use an ultrasensitive technology to be able to detect these very, very small concentrations of NFL, both in the plasma as well as within the exosomes. What we're really finding is important is to understand the activity of NFL within exosomes, as it provides us a unique opportunity to understand brain-related processes in a peripheral sample of blood, giving us insights into the very complex pathology that we know is implicated in recovery from brain injuries, and even those brain injuries that occurred years previously.
Great. So then just to restate, the exosomal neurofilament light is really much more of a clear indicator of what's going on in the central nervous system. That's really interesting. Kimbra, let's move to you next. you all looked at a group of almost 200 veterans and found that there's a relationship between mild TBI, repetitive TBI, and how these two biomarkers, namely exosomal NfL and plasma NfL, change over time. Can you tell us about that relationship?
What we found was that, especially among those that had three or more lifetime repetitive TBIs, had significantly higher levels of both exosomal and plasma NfL neurofilament light, as well as elevated exosomal and plasma IL-6, interleukin-6, compared to both those that had either one to two TBIs or no lifetime TBI at all. And then we used some linear modeling, and we looked at the associations between these total number of TBIs, the biomarker levels of each of the biomarker we tested, and then a variety of neurobehavioral symptoms that are commonly associated with chronic TBI. And that is where we found that elevated exosomal and plasma NfL and plasma IL-6 correlated both with the total number of TBIs, so the higher the level correlated with a higher number of TBIs, as well as the severity of the symptoms that are commonly associated with PTSD, depression, and other neurobehavioral symptoms. So these results, they suggest that chronic axonal dysfunction and or neuroinflammation could be a possible basis underlying these chronic persistent symptoms and those with repetitive or greater than three lifetime TBIs.
Thank you, Kimbra. So just to reiterate, we did find an elevation of exosomal NfL and plasma NfL that was higher in patients who were exposed to repetitive traumatic brain injury. So Jessica, did you guys also check CSF NfL?
No, we did not. The reason we did not look at cerebral spinal fluid is really the focus of these studies in my lab, as well as with Sensi, is to maximize the ability of peripheral blood to provide insights into central mechanisms of TBI. The reason for this is CSF requires a very invasive lumbar puncture, which limits the number of individuals that we can have in our studies. We looked at exosomes, which we know cross the blood-brain barrier. And with NfL being centrally related, we know that the cells or the neurons are communicating using NfL and the cargo of exosomes. We can then isolate those exosomes in the blood and understand central processes without needing CSF. So we're now able to really use the blood to understand these central mechanisms in a much more specific way without needing to use CSF.
Great. It really seems like we can actually get a good look at what the CSF neurofilament light profile might look like through this exosomal NfL evaluation. And Kimbra, can we draw these labs in clinic? It sounds rather specialized what you guys have in your lab. And I know, for example, the podcast that we recorded back in March on drawing blood NfL levels in MS on the March 16th, 2020 podcast, that in Switzerland, it was becoming more and more commonplace. But is this something that you can send your patients down to the lab after a clinic visit to have drawn?
So no, these labs aren't yet available in a clinical lab. They were performed in a research lab on a much smaller scale than what would be performed in a commercial clinical lab. And more importantly, our study results really are preliminary and why we called it a discovery project. We tested a panel of candidate biomarkers, but we need to follow the same group of 95 with serial blood draws and see how their levels change over time and if those changes correlate with severity of symptoms or even neurodegenerative condition development as they get even further decades out from their brain injuries.
Great. So not quite ready for prime time like we might be in the multiple sclerosis world. Last question I'm going to send over to Jessica. NfL is thought to reflect axonal damage, as you've discussed earlier, but you specifically investigate inflammatory markers as well. What methods are you or other TBI experts studying in relationship to these findings? Should the focus for treatment be on reducing inflammation, and if so, by what means?
So overall, our findings, you know, start to lead us to think that chronic inflammation, also coupled with NfL, may be players in some of the processes in neurons that are making some of these veterans more susceptible to the development of these chronic symptoms. It's really complex to think about where we can actually intervene, but thinking that we know how to modulate inflammation gives us some insights of where we can start to really look at therapeutic options to address these injuries even years after they've occurred. And so it provides some exciting avenues to look into. And so we're definitely going to be following up on these results.
Absolutely. So really interesting work. I congratulate both of you on this ongoing research and look forward to the next installment as you add what sounds like a substantial number of veterans to your cohort. And hopefully we'll be able to draw significantly more information. Again, I've been speaking with Kimber Kenny and Jessica Gill on their paper coming out in this week's Journal of Neurology, Exosomal NFL, a Prognostic Biomarker for Remote Symptoms After Mild Traumatic Brain Injury. For more podcasts on NFL, please listen back to our previous NFL podcast recorded earlier this year on blood NFL levels in the setting of multiple sclerosis from March 16th, 2020. Jessica and Kimber, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, David.
This is Jose Merino. Please check out this week's journal, which features an interesting article on CLN3 disease staging system and its use for clinical research in patients with Batten disease, and another article on plasma neurofilament light levels and the risk of disability in patients with multiple sclerosis. Please take a look at this and other articles this week. Thank you again for listening and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.